From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Part of Atlanta's entertainment scene is in a state of flux. Many comedy venues around the city can't seem to find their footing anymore. That's despite a whole host of successful comedians who come through town to perform every so often. Today, we'll talk about making space for comedy. And one of those successful comedians I mentioned will join us as well.
You know, when I'm in the checkout lane and dude's checking me out, but he's checking me out, you know. He's like, hey, girl, you know, I really like to take you out. I mean, you know, like after you lose like 20 or 30 pounds. Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you over the minimum wage. What'd you say?
That's Dulce Sloan. The Georgia comedian just took home top honors from an NBC competition. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, the Georgia playlist always gets great responses from you. Yesterday, local label owner Chris Farmer introduced us to an obscure Atlanta band called Kaiser Soze.
They weren't really around for a very long period. I don't think it was more than 3 or 4 years, but I thought they made a big impact on the Atlanta scene and probably influenced a lot of musicians. I know they influenced me. Their bass player was very inspiring, made me really want to try to bring my playing up to the next level to be competitive.
And we've asked for your help with exposure to more Georgia music acts. Here are your first thoughts. Adam Smith tweeted us about the Glands and one of their songs called Swim.
I can hear the ocean and it's calling you to come. It goes, hey, hey, Joe, come on in, the water's warm. We've been here waiting for you.
Speaking of music, there is a new video of Make an Artist Taurus on our Facebook page. GPB's Grant Blankenship shot the live performance footage and interviewed her about her Georgia roots, and it's a really great watch. You can see it at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. While you're there, leave us a comment about a Georgia musician that you have not heard on this show yet. We always want to know and hear what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. And we're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. President Obama will announce new executive actions later this morning that will tighten the nation's gun laws, things like requiring more gun sellers to be licensed. That follows a string of mass shootings around the country, but there really is still a lot that we don't know about gun violence. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta studies a host of public health issues. Gun violence is one of them, but it's very limited in its research in this area. Should shootings be viewed as a public health issue? Someone who has thought a lot about this is Garen Wintemute. He oversees the Violence Prevention Research Program at the UC Davis School of Medicine, and he joins me on the line. Hi, Garen.
Good morning.
And also with us is Mark Rosenberg. He's the head of the Task Force for Global Health, which is based in DeKalb County, and you've been working on this issue for literally decades, have you not, Mark?
A long time, Celeste. Yes.
Is it fair to say that what we know about gun violence is relatively limited in the U.S.? Is that fair?
Well, we know different sorts of things. From public health, we want to know four things about the problem about gun violence. First, what's the problem? Who, what, where, when, how does it happen? How many people are shot? What's the relationship between the shooter and the victim? What kind of weapon? Where does it come from? But we want to answer first the questions any good reporter would ask. The second thing we want to know is what are the causes? What are the risk factors? What increases the chance that someone will be shot? What protects people? What decreases it? But the second is, what are the causes? Third, what works to prevent it? And this is getting more complicated now because it's harder to figure out what works and what the impact of a certain type of measure or intervention will be. And then the last question we ask is, how do you do it? How do you implement something that works on a small scale? How do you make it a larger scale program? But we want to ask those four different questions to a problem like gun violence. And in this country, we know something about the problem, the who, what, where, when, and how. We know a little bit about the causes, but we know almost nothing about what works to prevent it. because we were stopped in our efforts to find the answers.
And you were actually part of that, which we're going to go back to that story in a moment. But I wanted to ask you, Garen, you know, when you look up the number of people both injured by gunshot and killed, those numbers differ according to what source you're looking at. Why?
Well, the number killed, there's pretty good agreement on. I think there are different definitions in play of what constitutes violence. One of the misunderstandings of firearm violence is that it's primarily a crime problem. But two-thirds of the deaths from firearm violence are self-inflicted. They're suicides. I'm an ER doc, and I know from experience that the wound doesn't depend on whose finger's on the trigger. Suicide is a form of violence. So if you count both homicide and suicide, there are upwards of 30,000 deaths a year from firearm violence. And to go back to your initial statement, if violence isn't a public health problem, then why are all these people dying from it?
Well, we asked this question on Twitter, whether or not the gun violence should be studied as a public health issue. We got this response, Mark, from T-Barf, who says, guns are objects that those prone to violence can use. The cultural roots of violence is an issue. So he's saying it shouldn't be studied as a public health issue. And I wanted to return to what you mentioned earlier, this fight over whether or not the CDC in particular should study it. Now, we're going back, I guess, 20 years at this point, when a Republican-led Congress stripped $2.5 million from the CDC. Mm-hmm. And let me read what they said. In the words of this, what became known as the J. Dickey Amendment, they said no funds for the CDC Injury Center, quote, may be used to advocate or promote gun control. Why did that, in effect, sort of shut down research at the CDC?
Well, I think for a few reasons. The first was, and we need to understand this, there was no ban on doing research. It was a restriction on advocating for gun control. And CDC was not advocating for gun control. CDC was doing research, very important, legitimate scientific research. But that language was a shot across the bow. And it warned researchers and it warned politicians and bureaucrats that if you try to study this problem of gun violence, we will harass you. We will have senators write to the secretary of HHS and question you. We will make sure that we can use all your time answering our inquiries, but we're going to harass you if you work in this field. The second thing that they did was they stripped the money so that CDC did not have the money to put out requests for proposals. So researchers in the field have to find an area where they can support the research if they're going to commit their time. So it said, we're going to harass you. It took away their money. And then finally, CDC fired the director of the Injury Center, who had been very interested in promoting the science of gun violence prevention.
I want to play a clip. This is from 1996, and this is NRA spokesman Lars Daleside. And he spoke with NPR, and he said at the time their lobbying for this J. Dickey Amendment was specifically because they didn't want the CDC advocating for a ban on guns.
The NRA is not and never has been opposed to research that promotes the safe and responsible use of firearms and work to reduce gun-related deaths.
Garen, I wonder if you think there has been sort of a cooling on research in terms of guns, because as I looked, there doesn't even see private donors willing to step up to the plate and fund this kind of research.
There's absolutely been a chill. We had a research program in the 90s that lost its funding when CDC was no longer able to make grants. We have pieced things together, but yes, there are a small number of private foundations that have been willing to provide funding. The National Institute of Justice has had a small research program just in the last couple of years. The National Institutes of Health have begun funding research. But the larger picture is, if I can, this. We are not a country that turns its back on research and innovation. We are a smart country. We like having the answers to tough questions so that we can use those answers to solve tough problems. We've proven that with motor vehicle trauma. We've proven it with cancer and heart disease and the diseases that come from smoking. And here's this one exception. When it comes to firearm violence, we have simply turned our back on what America does best. The open question is how many people have died as a result.
I want to play another one for you, Mark, and this is, we haven't mentioned so far that the number of people who are killed by gun violence every year in the U.S. is somewhere north of 30,000 people. Here we hear Sandro Galea, the dean of Boston University's School of Public Health, and Boston, at least, says that as many as 190,000 people are injured. And one of the reasons Sandra says we should treat this like a public health issue is because you have to consider the other people affected by gun violence rather than just the victim.
Then you have the family members of the those who died, and probably 10 to 20% of them will also go on to have long-term emotional sequelae. So very, very quickly, you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who are affected by this epidemic. And there is no other way of characterizing this than it is an epidemic and it is a preventable epidemic.
Help me understand what he's talking about there. Now, we had a report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics that spoke to this as well, the sort of ripple effect of gun violence. How's that different from other violence?
We're just starting to understand the consequences of violence in this country. We used to think that it meant you had to repair the wound or a broken arm or a broken leg. But what we found out now is that violence experienced by children leads to long-term impacts, which this country can't even afford to take care of. It leads to hypertension, to asthma, to drug use, to violence, to suicide. Massive, massive impacts on the future health of people. So that fixing the wound, fixing the injury is the tiniest, tiniest part of the problem. I want to say something else, and I want to say something about Garen Wintemute. Garen is an extraordinary and brilliant researcher who has been so committed to this field, even when research funding dried up. CDC has an extraordinary bunch of people ready to do scientific research on this. They have the largest collection of scientists in the world dedicated to violence prevention. But we're not letting people like Garen or CDC do the research that can save us. And it's because of what the NRA did. And what was said before is not quite right. The NRA framed it as either or. Either you do research and take all our guns away, or you don't do any research and you let us keep our guns. They framed it as a stark black and white. If you so much as talk about research about guns, then we will shut you down. And it's not either or. We can do the research, we can find out what works, and we can prevent abuse of gun rights. We can protect the gun rights of people if we do the research right. And Jay Dickey, who proposed that amendment, has come out and said it was a mistake.
Yeah, he's changed his mind.
Totally. 180 degrees. We need the research, and this will lead us out of this morass.
Well, this is a conversation that should and needs to continue, and we wanted to put it to our listeners as well. Do you think gun violence should be considered and studied as a public health issue? You can join this conversation with us on Twitter or Facebook. My guests this morning have been, you just heard the voice of Mark Rosenberg. He's with the Task Force for Global Health, and also Garen Wintemute. He's the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Garen and Mark, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
This is On Second Thought. A quick story that you may be interested in. While most of Georgia was celebrating Christmas and Kwanzaa and Hanukkah and a number of other December holidays, one man from Snellville was fighting for his right to wear a kitchen utensil on his head. Chris Avino subscribes to the Pastafarian religion. Avino is part of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. That's a group created 10 years ago that opposes the teaching of creationism and intelligent design in public schools, and its proponents sometimes wear colanders on their heads. Chris Avino wore his colander for the photo on his temporary driver's license, but when he went to get his permanent license, the state of Georgia protested. He received a letter from the Georgia Department of Driver Services that said state law allows people to wear a veil, scarf, or headdress in their photos, but, quote, a colander is not a veil, scarf, or headdress. A colander is a kitchen utensil commonly used for washing or draining food. DDS went on to say that Pastafarianism is not a real religion, but a philosophy that mocks religions. They ordered him to retake his photo within 10 days. Avino responded with his own letter. He said, quote, In Pastafarianism, a colander is worn in the head as a form of religious expression. What right does DDS have to tell me that my religion is not a real religion? Avino also said, you may find our beliefs to be strange, but as strange as you may feel they are still our beliefs. Some may find it strange that Christians believe Jonah spent 3 days in the belly of a whale. The Department of Driver Services has not yet responded to Avino's letter, which you can find at our Facebook page, facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and leave us a comment while you're there with your thoughts on Chris Avino and his colander. Should he be allowed to wear the colander for his driver's license photo if it doesn't obscure his face? We might feature what you have to say on our show. Social clubs for specific ethnicities are pretty common on college campuses, but one such club at Mercer University takes a different approach than most. Its members work to include everyone into their celebrations. GPB's Jayla Moody has that story.
Mercer women are dressed in colorful saris as they enter a room filled with the smell of Indian cuisine. Mercer sophomore Tasneem Huda welcomes students to Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights celebrated in late fall.
Tonight we have an amazing night. There's been a ton of hours I've gone into prepping for this night, and we're so excited that it's finally here.
The festival was organized by a new campus group called Mercer Masala. It was founded by senior Utkarsh Parwal.
Masala translates to spice, you know, flavor, and I think that's really what we bring to the community. We try to do is just share our culture with everyone else.
Parwal used to be a part of the Indian Cultural Exchange Club, an association of South Asian students on campus.
I knew I wanted to be part of something more than just that. I think inclusiveness is more important than exclusivity. I think it's really important that we bring in people and share ideas and not just, you know, label ourselves with one, you know, one country.
Most of the members of the club are of South Asian descent. Most of the faces in the choir and at the festival are not.
When I see other cultures and other people with different backgrounds coming, I love it. It's fantastic. That's the point, and it's working.
After raffling off a few Mercer Masala t-shirts, club members assemble on the stage to sing a song that isn't exactly traditional.
Hello from the other side.
Graduating this year, but he has faith that his organization will continue to grow without him.
I want to see how something we started grew into Mercer, became part of the Mercer-like atmosphere. And that's Masala in its essence. You know, it's people from different backgrounds, different things, putting what they have on the table and seeing what happens. You know, so I think the club does what it's supposed to.
Parwal is planning for their biggest spring event, the Hindu Festival of Holi. Traditionally, revelers hurl brightly colored paint at each other, something college students of any ethnicity can get into. For GPB News, I'm Jayla Moody.
Over the past few months, we've interviewed comedians Hal Sparks, Chris Kattan, and George Wallace before their sets at the Atlanta Improv Comedy Club. But the club closed on New Year's Day after 3 years of being in business. The building complex that housed the Improv sold their leases to another company, and now the future of the club is unclear. Other comedy venues around Atlanta have had to deal with some recent relocations. The Punchline and Dad's Garage are included in that. And so we wanted to kind of get a read on the comedy scene in Atlanta from the people who run it. Jamie Bendel, welcome back, is the owner of the Punchline Comedy Club. Hi, Jamie.
It is a treat to be here with you this morning.
Laura Smith is the managing director of the improv theater company Dad's Garage. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
And Andrew George is the booker and manager of the Laughing Skull. Hey there, Andrew.
Hello.
Okay, so Laura, let me go to you first and see, look, there's so many moves and relocations and closings and reopenings. Do we have reason to be worried about the state of comedy clubs in Atlanta?
You know, it's interesting because Dad's Garage is an improv group,
right?
And so it's hard for me to speak about comedy clubs. I can
but
really
you have
only
some stand up there
occasionally, but we really focus on improv comedy and scripted works. So I can really only speak from our perspective and say that, you know, for us, we managed to be so successful because of sort of the family of people around us. And so we have 50 performers that perform with us on a regular basis, which is just a very different business model than from a place like, for instance, the Atlanta Improv. So I don't feel like I can speak on that.
But we don't think you the relocation of Dad's garage is not a cause for
concern.
Oh,
not at all. So we actually opened on New Year's Eve. That was our first performance, and we're celebrating all this month with Dad's Garage and friends. We're bringing in friends from all over, including we're doing partnerships with the Atlanta Opera, the Atlanta Ballet, but then also we've got the likes of Colin Mockery coming in to improvise with us, and we actually. You know, it's interesting because this place, I think, actually secures the legacy for us. Because what happened in Imnan Park is we spent 18 years in one location and we had really helped turn around the neighborhood and then simply couldn't afford to be there anymore.
You got gentrified out.
And we helped do it to ourselves. So when we were looking for locations, we really wanted to find somewhere that was close, but we had no idea that we would be able to purchase a place and really secure our home for the future.
Okay, so Jamie, you were on our show last March, and you were talking about a documentary about the Punchline, and I want to play a clip of you for you.
Okay.
Here you are describing what it's like to go through the curtains in your old location.
One of the things that I think has been particularly special about the Punchline is that on the very first night when Jeff Foxworthy goes out, he stands on the same boards that Richard Pryor has stood on, and that Eddie Murphy has stood on, and Jerry Seinfeld, and the amateur who goes through for the very first time in their very first set in that room, in that moment, is a part of that great tradition.
So is that lost with a move?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One, thank goodness that cold has passed. And second, we actually inlaid on our new stage in our new showroom
the boards
from the old stage. And that was really one of those things that was important to us.
What a great idea.
There's a little bit of that continuity. And really, you know, to your point about what are these moves and what do these changes signify? Well, it really kind of changes that there is a bit of a renewal that is part of the Atlanta tradition. So many of what I would call the iconic brands, particularly related around entertainment. Dad's Garage is a household name, 18 years in existence. We've in our 34th year now.
Congratulations.
Manuals, yeah. Right, is going yeah. through the same thing. Alfredo's, there was just something in the paper. So that really is part of the magic of the Atlanta story. And we were chatting in the green room, and it's easy as a business owner to sometimes get stuck in your bubble and worry simply about what your challenges are. But it is a great reminder when you pick your head up and you have to go through this process of transition to remember that there are brand new people coming to the city who have no experience with the old space, who have no experience with what the old traditions are. And so for all of us that are involved in the creative arts, it's how do you keep that vibrancy new, and how do you introduce the new improv player, and how do you introduce the new comedian? And it's a great, it really is a terrific process.
Has the size your possible audience size shrunk or gotten bigger?
Well, we used the transitional time to go out and be where our customers were.
What does that
and
mean?
And it was, we did pop-up shows. So we'd say, we're coming to this part of town and we do a pop-up. We're going to that part of town and doing a pop-up. Because the feedback that we got from our customers was, we love your business, but our life has changed. And that's kind of true for a lot of brands. And as the people move farther away from maybe where you started, the visit to your original location becomes more of a special event. And encouraging people to come and still interact with you, it's sometimes okay to go out and say, how about I meet you halfway?
I don't know if you experienced this, but in our transition, we tried, you know, we were in quite a few different places, and we actually learned a lot about how we wanted to design the new space. So we found that sort of the ability to hop around better informed our choices in the new permanent home.
Well, let me bring Andrew into this because he's just leaning back, getting comfortable.
Very nice chair.
So let me ask you about this. Are you finding that you're having to make changes to accommodate different demands of your audience?
No. We're blessed in the sense that we're attached to the Vortex in Midtown, which is an insanely popular restaurant in Atlanta. So we kind of tap into that fan base. Also, our location, we're on Peachtree Street. We have a giant, essentially, billboard in the front of our business. So that helps a lot. And we were talking in the green room, ever since, anytime the economy isn't as good as it can be, entertainment goes up. So we haven't seen really a fluctuation in audiences.
But wait, so if you're... entertainment, if your audiences went up or increased during the recession, now that recession's over, have you seen them go back down?
No, because those people come in during that recession and realize, oh, this is a great opportunity. We can just come see comedy. This is an easy date, which I'd say 75% of our audiences are dates. So people realize during that time, like, oh, I can just keep going, keep doing this. So we kind of, I feel like we pick up business during the recession and then carry that on until people get enough money to do something else.
But Dad's Garage, Laura, has been experimenting with a number of other things, like a digital series with Amber Nash and other things that it sounds like you are trying to respond to different demands of your audience.
Yeah, you know, we really talk about ourselves as the entry point into the arts. So we try to make accessible artwork, both in terms of what the art is and also in terms of financially. And what the art is means sometimes meeting people where they are. So we are going to continue to do things in our home theater and then do other things like the web series Heart of America to drive attention to the home theater and get people excited about coming.
So then tell me, Jamie, I mean, Atlanta has a fairly large number of comedy clubs or improv clubs related to our population. I mean, per capita, we have a pretty good number. Do we have the audience that supports it?
Well, you know, Celeste, I'm going to embrace that hypothetical because I don't want to give any opportunity for somebody to think that, in fact, we are underserved from a comedic perspective. When you think about it, one of the interesting things about if you consider the metro generally, right?
The whole
11 counties. Okay. We actually have a massive geographic area that we cover. And I think one of the great challenges is if people who are involved in the creative endeavors, people who are involved in artistic endeavors, feel as though there is a finite number of potential customers. The people who might come to the Punchline to see a particular act are people who might go to the Laughing Skull to see a different act on a different occasion and might go to Dad's Garage to see improv on another night. So we're not really in competition with each other to the extent that you go, I have a finite amount of entertainment dollars that I'm going to spend and I'm going to spend them in a particular way. So really where Atlanta is challenged is, at least in the comedy perspective, is we actually have so many different venues beginning at like the 500, 600 seat size and going up that, in fact, there's more top-end pressure than there is bottom-end pressure. There's always a new person who wants to try improv for the first time. There's always going to be a person who wants to start pursuing stand-up comedy. So there are any number of opportunities to sort of bubble in at the bottom. But once you reach a certain level, there is this upward pressure that pulls you out of a Punchline or a Laughing Skull or an Improv when it was open and pushes you into a Buckhead Theater or a Variety Playhouse or whatever. And that's really where Atlanta is very different than a lot of cities because it isn't that way in other markets.
Andrew, I mean, we only have a couple minutes left here, but I wonder if you agree with that sort of friendly perspective.
Absolutely. Whatever is best for comedy is best for the venues, because someone's not going to come to the Punchline and see a headliner and go, I'm only going to see that headliner ever again. And they're going to go, oh, I love comedy. I can see more comedy. So they're going to go to Google, figure out who's coming to Atlanta. And it doesn't matter what venue it's at. As long as they're seeing comedy, that's the best part, because Atlanta has one of the best stand-up scenes in the world as far as our locals. And the clubs are fine and dandy and everything, but there's
You mean in terms of the talent that's here?
The locals, yeah. The people who live in Atlanta and the city. We have some of the best comedians in the world.
Yeah,
here.
We're about to hear from...
Yeah, Dulce Sloan will be here in a minute. She's absolutely hilarious. But there's so many shows, not even at the clubs. There's 4 shows a night in Atlanta you can go to. Some for free, even. There's bar shows, there's open mics everywhere. So there's so much comedy happening in the city.
That's my question. And Laura, let me bring you into this, because I wonder if you feel this competition from other places that have a night of improv or like Friday night is their night.
Not at all. I think of it more like movies. So if you see a trailer for a movie and you see a trailer for 2 movies that you like, are you going to be like, you know what, I'm only going to see 1 of those movies? Or are you going to decide to prioritize your time to see both of those movies? That's what you're going to do. So when we think of who our competition is, it's like Netflix, video games, right. Hanging out at a bar. Like, we're competing for people's time and attention, not for which comedy venue they go to.
Well, and, you know, the only thing that I would add to that, so there are a lot of comedians that make their home in Atlanta, and I would imagine that there is a growing actor population as our entertainment infrastructure has grown.
That's correct.
We've become really a nice hub for entertainment in the most broad sense. Really, the bigger challenge is, I think, how individual artists and comedians are fundamentally entrepreneurial, right? We've got to promote our shows
right,
and do our stuff,
right?
The challenge is there are so many opportunities to go up in some respects, and there are so many opportunities to participate in the scene. It almost is the opposite of scarcity. So I don't need to see this performer tonight because I can see them tomorrow night, or I can see them Thursday, or I can see them four times next week.
Yeah.
And that presents a very different challenge for the individual performer in terms of their individual brand management. But certainly a great entry point to any of these things that we're talking about is to use sort of the trusted names in the market, be it a Dad's Garage or any of the comedy clubs.
That's Jamie Bendel. He's the owner of the Punchline Comedy Club. I guess they're all setting my worries about the comedy scene in Atlanta to rest. Laura Smith is the manager. Director of Dad's Garage. Andrew George is the manager and booker for Laughing Skull. Thanks to all of three of you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
This is On Second Thought. A few months ago, I spoke with comedian Margaret Cho, who rose to fame in the 1990s with a very unapologetic take on society and culture. Cho has influenced a number of other comics over the years, including my next guest, Atlanta comedian Dulce Sloan, who also offers a pretty unapologetic take on society.
I don't know how gentrification is hitting y'all, but it's hitting Atlanta real hard. And it's humorous because they like to trick people who are moving into these formerly horrible neighborhoods. Like they changed the name of one street from Stewart Avenue to Metropolitan Parkway, like hookers were going to get confused.
Dulce Sloan has carved her niche as a Black Southern female comic, and she's getting a lot of attention for her work. She recently won NBC's annual stand-up comedy showcase. So I guess the first thing I should say to you is congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's not the first prize award that you've won.
No, 2015 was crazy. I got a lot of things in 2015. I got second place in the Laughing Skull Festival, and the owner of the festival told me like 400, 500 people submitted to the Laughing Skull Festival.
That's crazy.
And they only took 72 people. So I got second place. And then I got into a very prominent festival, Bridgetown Comedy Festival. And then I got New Faces, which is at Just for Laughs in Montreal.
And you were in the Women in Comedy Festival.
It was Women in Comedy Festival.
The Cape Fear Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
I wonder, is it a different act that you would do for a competition as opposed to one that you just do for a gig at a club?
No.
You do the same thing.
Because I have to, those club gigs got me the jokes that I could do at the festivals and I can do in the competitions. So what you would do is like, I'd pick my best jokes to do in a festival. Or the strongest jokes that I have, so the jokes that I would use is like my openers and my closers, I would do at festivals. But newer jokes I probably wouldn't do, or
things. You don't experiment.
You don't really experiment, especially competition festivals. Like competition festivals, you use your best jokes because you want to win. But with other festivals, like with Just for Laughs, because getting new faces is a huge deal.
Yeah.
And so much of the industry comes, like LA is like, okay, we're leaving. And then they go to Montreal in Canada, and then everybody sees you. All of the networks come, talent agents come, managers come, casting directors come. All of LA picks up and goes to Montreal to see who the new faces are. For the people that are repped, that means they have management. The people who are unrepped that don't have management. And then they added a characters category. So people who do more improv or more sketch, to be able to give them access to the industry as well. They added that whole new category so everybody gets to be seen.
You know, you've listed Margaret Cho as one of your influences. And she's kind of seeing a sort of resurgence.
Yes.
I spoke to her in October about the failure of her 1990s TV show that was called All American Girl. And she said part of the reason why that show didn't work was because she was being marginalized. Take a listen.
I was also being managed by a team from UCLA who were trying to make sure that we were Korean, which is another weird thing, that we were held to this authenticity, which didn't come out in the comedy, but sort of had more to do with appeasing people to think that we were doing the right thing. I don't know. White people are never kind of put under that sort of microscope of being authentically ethnic. But we had to be authentically ethnic, which sort of hurt us a lot in terms of comedy and then what we were able to do.
You know, it's been decades since that show went off the air. I wonder if you think that has changed, if you feel this pressure to sort of be authentically Black in your comedy.
Well, I remember that show.
You watched it.
I watched that show. I remember when she had a show on VH1. the Cho Show, I always paid attention to what she did because I'd never thought about being a stand-up comic. Someone told me I was a stand-up comic. That's how I got into it.
When was that? How old were you?
I was, that was 2000, it was 2007. So I was like in my early 20s. I wasn't 25 yet. And I had a stand-up comic tell me at the Funny Farm that I needed to start doing stand-up. I've been acting since I was a kid. I have a theater degree from Brunel University. And so he told me in 2007 I was a stand-up comic. And I said, no, I'm not. Go away. And I kept running into him at different events. So like more than three times, I'm like, okay, this isn't a coincidence. This has to be fate. So he taught a stand-up class at the Funny Farm. And the Funny Farm closed. And then the stand-up class moved to the Laughing Skull. So my first time performing stand-up comedy was in May of 2009 at the Laughing Skull. And it had only been open for like a couple of months. So that's how I got into it. And I have a lot of situations where people ask me, you know, like I was doing a podcast and someone was saying like, oh, you know, you have this identity of like the sassy black woman. And I'm like, no, I'm myself. The only people that call me sassy are white people. The only time I've given this trope of the angry black woman or the sassy black woman or whatever is when white people say that. Black people, I'm just a black person who talks. You know what I mean? So I've not had to, like, I don't have to prove my blackness to anybody because I'm black all day. So, and if anyone questions my blackness, they're usually white or a black person I don't know. So, and I don't try to make excuses for my comedy. I don't try to explain it to anybody. If you get it, you get it. You don't, you don't. But I obviously know what I'm doing. So, you know, I try to say the things that are truthful to me and, you know, it seems to resonate with people, but I can't spend a lot of time trying to explain my personality to people. You can figure it out when I'm on stage and when I'm in person, but it's, you know, and Margaret's right. We spend a lot of time trying to prove our ethnicity, but Margaret Cho doesn't have to prove she's Korean. Look at her. I don't have to prove that I'm black. Look at me. You know.
Let me play a clip from your show so our listeners understand what you're talking about when you talk about your stand-up. Take a listen.
I was worried to wear my afro out in Los Angeles because I didn't know if I had to wax on and wax off white women from touching my afro. Because they're not classy when they touch the afro. They don't want to keep it Christian when they get in here. No, ma'am. They want to take their whole hand and go straight to the scalp. Shake it back and forth. While she's looking at her friend going, Lauren, it's so soft. It's like a poodle. It's so soft.
Do you ever, when you're writing jokes and you say you're just talking like you normally talk, but do you think about your audience where you go, who your demographic is going to be when you're doing your gig?
I had to quit doing that.
Why?
Because, like, well, there's one part of that joke that y'all didn't do is, like, the part where it's exiting my afro with the jellyfish action, which is my favorite part of that joke. But, you know, the Atlanta comedy scene, you know, you spoke to, you know, the Laughing Skull and Dad's Garage and the Punchline. But the comedy scenes in every single city is split between what's considered mainstream and urban. So the white rooms and the black rooms. And so, you know, at the beginning, I would try to go, well, let me do these jokes here. Let me do these jokes here. But, you know, two comics that have had a lot of success after leaving the city is Clayton English and Rob Hayes. And they do the exact same jokes in, you know, both rooms. Like Rob Hayes is doing a Harry Potter joke at Uptown. That seems crazy to anybody else, but it worked.
Because Uptown is what would be considered a sort of an urban club.
It's a black room. It's a black room. And so, but what he was able to do is he used, you know, the idea of Quidditch and, you know, the idea of, like, if there's basketball wives, there's Quidditch wives. So, like, oh, they watch basketball wives and just giving them this. So he was
Quidditch
able...
Quidditch is the sport that the Harry Potter characters play on brooms.
Yeah. I've never seen any of these movies. People just told me about it because he had explained it to me. But what he was able to do is he took these two abstract ideas and put them together. So he was able to do those jokes. So he could do the joke in both rooms and not have to change them.
So have you noticed a difference since you stopped, tailoring your act?
It's been a lot. It makes you think more about what you're saying. So because the ability to not have to flip and flop, the ability to go, I can say my material exactly the same in this room, exactly the same at this room, lets you know that you have a wide stream appeal. Lets you know that you can do any of these rooms and you don't have to, you know, try to. To me, it's almost like, I don't want to use this term, but it's like a shuck and a jive. Like, okay, I'm going to be this way in these rooms and this way in these rooms. But, you know, and you do tailor things, because the only thing that you really have to change is that in a lot of the urban rooms, it's you have to have more laughs per minute than you do in the mainstream rooms. The mainstream rooms will allow you to have a longer of a setup on a joke. Hmm. But in the urban rooms, they want to laugh like every 30, 45 seconds.
Faster pace.
So the longer jokes that I have those because, you know, my mentor, Big Kenny, you know, started in urban rooms. He taught me to have those, even in long setups, have those little jokes to give the audience just a little bit. So you're stacking your laugh.
Well, then let me ask you something else about different audiences, because there's been a number of big name comedians who've said they won't play college campuses anymore. And you've done a number of shows on colleges. I assume you still do shows at colleges?
I did my first college show back in November.
Uh-huh.
And I'm starting to, and I'm going to have like 20 something college shows coming up in the next like 3 months.
Yeah. So I wonder how you feel about this, because a number, like I said, there's been four or five big names who said, I won't do college campuses anymore because the students are too sensitive. They can't take a joke. What do you think about that? Do you then worry as you're preparing for all these shows at colleges?
I'm not in a tax bracket where I can look at somebody and say, I can't do that show. So if, because I have a joke about my bra and I was told that I can't do that joke. So I'm just not going to do it. I'm not in the place where I can go, I'm not going to do this. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I've gone to, because for me, it's the same as like when I do certain clubs in certain places, they're like, all right, you can't say the F word. You can't say these words. You can't say these words. So if I can go to a club and they can tell me I can't cuss, then if I go to a college campus and they'll just go, look, don't cuss, tone it down. Don't be as sexual as you might be. And I'll go, okay. Because for me, I'm not Jerry Seinfeld. I can't tell you I'm not going to do anything. So if you tell me not to cuss and don't talk about my bra, I'm going to go, cool, and then get a check. Like, I can't look at you and go, I'm not going to do this.
Well, then let me play you a clip, because we just spoke with comedian George Wallace. He's been doing stand-up for 40 years. He was here in Atlanta just a little while ago, and he explained why he has stayed in stand-up comedy for as long as he has.
There is no sex, there's no drugs like doing comedy. It's the most wonderful thing you could ever do. Laughter is the greatest medicine in the world. And what's good about laughter, it's free medicine. So I encourage everybody to overdose on laughter. Keep it in the reach of children. And if you start laughing, you're laughing for more than 4 hours, then you call your doctor.
So let me ask you about this in terms of looking ahead. Do you have to make a plan for how to sustain yourself in the world of stand-up comedy, where you're pretty much, the pressure has to be pretty strong to constantly change the act and constantly be funny?
It is. And like, because a lot of people don't know, I started out as an actor. I've been acting since I was a child, and stand up kind of literally came out of nowhere. But doing stand up has given me the opportunity to get chances. You know, doing stand up has given me opportunities that I wouldn't have gotten. Like with the, you know, winning the Stand Up for Diversity, now I have a, you know, deal with NBC. I wouldn't have gotten that as an actor. All of these, you know, meetings that I've had with different studios, I wouldn't have gotten that if I stayed in acting. So it's definitely been the thing that has pushed me much farther, much faster than if I would have stayed in acting. So I have to be a comic, to be a good improviser, to be a good actor. So I have to continue to do all of these things, because all of those things got me to where I am. So be able to maintain and move forward, I have to keep doing all of these things, because once you start doing stand-up, like if you haven't gone up for like a week, you're like, oh man, I got to do a show. And you might not even, you know, you might have something new that you just thought about, or you might not have anything new. You need to just work your set because you have something coming up. So the need to do it is something that you can't really explain to somebody, because, you know, oh, I feel a little rusty, I haven't gone up in 2 weeks. But I've been doing stand-up for 6.5 years, but I can say to myself, oh, I feel a little rusty, I haven't gone up in 2 weeks. So it's something you have to do.
So then let me ask you about the kind of place that Atlanta is as, I guess, an incubator for comedic talent. Is it a relatively supportive place? Is it competitive?
It's very supportive. It's very supportive.
No cutthroat competition, and
I mean, we really don't have time for that. Like, to really tell the truth, it's if we, you know, when a new comic comes in, we're not trying to hide information from them. Because like when I started, there were no shows on a Tuesday and no shows on a Thursday. And now there are like 4 shows on a Tuesday, 5 shows on Wednesday. So comics have come in and really created a scene for ourselves because, you know, you've got, you know, now there's the Punchline and then there's the Skull are the 2 major clubs now. So if you're a younger comic coming in, you know, if you're 6 months in or even a year in, you're not going to be able to get on the weekends because you don't have enough time. You're not experienced enough. So the scene has created enough shows for those newer comics to really develop and be able to write those new jokes. And if you're, you know, if you have a new joke that you're working on or if it's a good set, you know, comics will come up to you and say good set or, hey, what do you think about this on your joke? We're always trying to talk to each other and help each other out because the more and more successful that other comics can be, the more and more that we can go, okay, we are working as a scene. We are helping each other. We are working together, you know, and that only helps more and more comics to become, to push Atlanta.
We only have about a minute left. When's your next time people can see you in Atlanta?
I've got 2 shows on Wednesday. I'm doing a Safe Place at the Orpheus Brewery. And then I am closing out Java Monkey in Decatur. And then this weekend, I'm going to be at the Laughing Skull for the Best Of show.
That is Atlanta comedian Dulce Sloan, the winner of NBC's Stand-Up Comedy Showcase. Dulce, congratulations again. It's been a
pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the changing face of DeKalb County. There's been a big drop in the number of African Americans living there, and the median income for blacks that do live there has gone down by 50%. Call us and tell us what you see in your own neighborhood. Have things changed there in your own town, on your own street? It's 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, it's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.